We live in a world of haves and have-nots. Some have an abundance of hydrocarbons and are making those who have not pay dearly for them. Others have not and seek to ameliorate their deficiency by converting food into fuel. This leads us to ask, which must come first, food or fuel?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Welcome aboard out there. You are tuned into the 592nd edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among a friend over there in Lisbon who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Hello, Nikki.
Hello.
Producer Carol Stett. What was that hello stuff?
Hello.
Producer Carol Stett.
Hello.
Parmalee Taff.
Hello.
Folks, consider this. Between the years 2000 and 2005, that's like 5 years there, relatively recent years, the average price for a bushel of corn was somewhere in the neighborhood of $1.80. Last month, the price for that bushel of corn reached $7.25. That is an increase of over 400% in but a few short years. Part of the reason for this incredible price increase is the diversion of food to fuel. Here in the United States, for example, one-third of the corn crop is slated to become ethanol. The incredible price increase for food means that many in the world are now going very hungry. And so today we ask, which must come first, food or fuel? Here to help us find an answer, we have David Bloom, author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas. Welcome back to the Food Chain, David.
Good morning, Michael.
Hey, last time we worked together, we made a prediction, and the prediction came true. What was that?
Well, that we would see the oil companies manipulate the price of corn to mess with the alcohol industry.
And the price, and you think that's what's going on with this incredible price increase?
Oh, without a doubt. Basically, what we're talking about here is the biggest smokescreen we've probably seen in 10 or 20 years in American media, that the idea that ethanol has anything to do with the increase in the price of corn or the availability of corn for food. Neither of those things are true, but the voices that are an authority, the people who really know, are being drowned out by the propaganda that drowns the media.
Okay. Also with us, David is the author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas, a relatively recent publication. It is the Bible, I guess, of ethanol. And David and I were just talking about speaking engagements we both had in Milwaukee. David was preaching the gospel of ethanol, and I was preaching the gospel of metropolitan agriculture. Two different audiences, but perhaps we'll meet soon somewhere down the lane here. Also with us today, we have Ratan Lal, who is a professor of natural resources from Ohio State University.
Good morning.
Welcome to the Food Chain, Professor. Pleasure to have you aboard. Natural resources, I guess we're talking hydrocarbons and carbohydrates, right?
Well, we are talking about soil science and soil, water, vegetation.
I guess it always starts at the soil, doesn't it?
That's right. That's the most basic resource. And so its management is crucial to food production.
Right.
And so that's the topic that I think we need to address in improving the production.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you heard David's assertion here, Professor, that that it appears to him as though the oil companies are the ones who are really raising havoc with the price of corn. Do you see any truth in that assertion?
It's possible, but my personal belief is that the increase in food production, increase in price of the food commodity, wheat, rice, and so forth, has happened also due to other factors. And the other factors that I think are important, the production of these crops has gone down considerably.
The production of corn has gone down?
Corn,
rice.
Wheat, rice. Food products, because of soil degradation.
Ah.
Because of change in climate, which has caused a drought. especially in Australia.
Did you say a chilling climate?
Changing climate.
Okay.
Global warming.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a serious drought in Australia that has lasted for many years, where mm-hmm. the rice production for export was a major factor.
And wheat.
And wheat, exactly. Wheat production in the Indo-Gangetic Basin, that's Punjab, Pakistan, India, Nepal, has been affected by high temperatures during spring.
Aren't they also having trouble with a wheat rust over there?
Correct, very correct. And there are problems with diseases and insect damage to rice cultivation.
What impact, Professor, do you see the emerging economies playing in this shortage as well?
Obviously, as the affluence increases mm-hmm. in China and India and other countries, that's also important. But I think the natural factors are really more important, which we need to address. And the drought certainly has created a problem. And then, of course, conversion of corn grains and soybean to ethanol and diesel has certainly raised the price of commodities.
Well, but up until now, Doctor, I would absolutely agree with you. But on the last point, when you're speaking that ethanol might have had an effect on the price of corn, that really is not the case. In the other two grains you mentioned, wheat and rice, natural occurrences have definitely reduced the amount of grain available, both because of the reduction of solar energy from the Asian brown cloud and the problems with drought. But when
Asian brown cloud?
Yes. There's so much hydrocarbon pollution in the atmosphere above much of Asia that we actually see a 10% or more reduction in sunlight reaching crops. So that's beginning to affect you.
Asian brown cloud.
Yes. But when it comes to corn, there was no shortage last year. In fact, the United States had the largest harvest of corn in 33 years. In fact, we had so much corn, we could not even store it all. We had not enough silo space. Every corn dryer had to be pressed into use as an additional silo, and mountains of corn were piled up outside of the elevators covered with tarps because we literally could not contain all the corn we produced. See, last year, we needed an extra 11 million acres or so of corn to partially go into alcohol plants. But of course, that market signal was received by the farmers well in advance, and so they planted 20 million acres of corn. And back in the early part of the year, Michael and I had a show about that. We said, that's going to crash the price of corn. There's going to be such a surplus.
Yeah.
Well, the surplus happened. In other words, we ended up having way more corn than we needed for both ethanol and for food, and the price still went up. That's a different story than there being shortages. That price has to do with other factors that have nothing to do with the shortage of corn, which we do not have. We do not have a shortage.
I fully agree with your analogy. In fact, I read that article that the production, and I congratulate the farmers and the policymakers in the U.S. Corn Belt for raising the production, and that's great. My concern, I think we also really need to explain to the audience the Asian brown cloud.
Please.
I fully agree with you. What has happened is over the Indian Ocean between India and Africa, there's a huge cloud of soot, and that soot is coming from fires and cooking fuel, the crop residue and wood fire and dung and everything that's used for cooking throughout South Asia and Africa has created a huge cloud of a continent size, which has impacted the energy budget of the Indian Ocean and therefore has influenced the monsoon throughout South Asia all the way up to China. And that is what we call traditional biofuels.
But it's also caused by coal, wouldn't you say, Doctor?
Well, coal is a part, but it's not the only part. The traditional biofuel, the cooking fire, the dung, the crop residue, the firewood, 75% of the rural community, and maybe more in Africa and South Asia, is using this kind of cooking fuel.
Because it's readily available.
Whereas that is the only available.
Only available.
Right? Only available.
You have to realize that over 2 billion people on the planet cook with wood fuel every night. And that is the biggest cause of deforestation on the planet.
That is, and I talked to the planning commissioner, chairperson of India. He asked me question, what could India do in this? And he was pretty surprised when I said provide clean cooking fuel to the rural housewives.
And I have an answer for that.
That's a very important. Now, coming back to your other question, so that was, Michael, for this Asian cloud, which has very important issues.
Dr. Pimit, or Dr. Lal, can you hold that? We have to take a quick break, but boy, this is getting really interesting, really fast. Folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking about food or fuel, food and fuel. Can we have one without the other? What do you think is the most important food or fuel? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. We have David Bloom, author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas, and Ratan Lal, who is a professor of natural resources, Ohio State University. And you do stay tuned. Right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, have you ever heard of the Asian brown cloud? I just learned about it today, and it might very well have an impact on our ability to buy food way over here in the United States. So let's talk about that Asian brown cloud. We'll go back with Ratan Lal, who's a professor of natural resources, Ohio State University. Ratan, could it have an impact on the rest of the world, this huge cloud? Oops, perhaps I better do this here.
Because the Asian monsoons are influenced and the energy budget on the whole continent is influenced by this brown cloud, it can have many ramifications. And if we were to really find a solution to this, which means replacing traditional biofuels, which is wood and crop residue and animal dung and other things of this nature, with modern biofuels, whether it's ethanol or whether it's electricity from biomass or any other thing, it can obviously have many, many implications.
Doctor, I write about
David Bloom here, the author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas, has an idea for a solution. So let's throw it to him and hear it.
You know, Doctor, you're absolutely right. You know, a lot of us in America say, oh, you know, the whole thing about oil is cars. But in most of the world, there's like one car for 20 people, and cooking is the primary use of energy. So there are initiatives now going on in different parts of the world where some of my readers have started building village-scale distilleries and encouraging people in the village to grow cassava or, in some cases, sugarcane, other energy crops that can then be made into alcohol right there in the village, where they can then be burned in inexpensive alcohol stoves. Some of these stoves are actually literally made out of 3 soda cans glued together with epoxy, and they are very effective at cooking. And the health effects are tremendous. Women cooking over these wood fires get tremendous number of eye disease and eye damage. The kids get chronic obstructive pulmonary disease from breathing in the wood smoke.
Just a quick aside for those people who are trying to imagine what we're talking about here. For those of you who have not traveled to the developing world regions of the world, what happens is that people don't have natural gas. I mean, they have to go, like Professor Lau was talking about, to the very primitive sources of energy, to camel dung. And if I had the opportunity to spend some time in Cairo, and at night, at dinner time, when people started cooking their dinners, there arose this tremendous stench into the air from people cooking over camel dung, literally camel dung. And so it's that smoke that you're talking about, right, David?
Yeah. Yes, and it gets worse because people have to, you know, once they deforest their local area, then they have to walk up to 6-7 hours one way to get an armload of wood so they can cook their food for the remaining week. And I was at a conference once where, you know, I thought I understood all the ecological implications of alcohol. And this researcher from Monsanto, who I'd been sparring with, stood up and said, well, of course, alcohol would stop AIDS then. Well, I was floored. I didn't see how that was connected. But she said, well, when these women walk 6 hours to get the wood, the chance of them running into a possible rape situation is pretty high. They pick up AIDS. They come back to their village, pass it to their husband, and then it gets passed around, and then the whole village dies. Or the husband catches it from a prostitute if he's getting the wood. It's like it never occurred to me that deforestation is connected to AIDS. And, of course, the solution, you know, ecological solution, which ties these things together, is to produce your fuel at home from alcohol, which is a very efficient way of collecting solar energy and very cleanly cooking it with no emissions indoors.
Professor Lau, does this sound reasonable to you?
Well, yes, I think I'm not a social scientist, but I think some of the points David is really incredible. But the fact that I'd like to mention that replacing these traditional fuels, animal dung, crop residue, these materials are needed to be applied on land to improve the soil quality.
Without a doubt.
And that is where the issue is. So we are degrading the soils of Africa and Asia where these natural resources should be applied back on soil. Let me give an example. More nutrients, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium are burnt in the dung on cooking fire in India than the chemical fertilizer applied.
Wow.
So imagine if that animal dung could be used.
We're robbing the bank.
Exactly. Essentially, we are robbing the soil. And we are robbing the fertility. So when people talk about the fertilizers applied are not being responsive, increasing the crop yield, the reason is the soil organic matter content of the soils of Africa and Asia is so low because we take away every piece of crop residue, the animal dung is taken away, nothing is returned back on the land. Therefore, the soils do not respond even when you apply fertilizers.
Absolutely.
Is this the core of the problem we see in countries like Ethiopia, which are perpetually, it seems, in situations of drought and starvation? And it's because to cook the food, they have robbed the bank of the soil bank.
Exactly. A few weeks ago, New York Times carried a couple of articles on how the African food production can be increased. You know, the Green Revolution in Asia, South Asia, India, Pakistan, Nepal, Bangladesh came during the 60s and 70s because improved varieties of rice and wheat and other crops were grown on irrigated soils with chemical fertilizers.
Right.
That Green Revolution bypassed Africa. And it bypassed because Africa fertilizer application rate is still 5 kilogram per hectare on a continental scale. Irrigation is only 5 million hectare compared to India alone, 60 million hectare. Indian fertilizer rate has gone up from 60 to the same level as in Africa, 5 kilogram to 100 kilogram per hectare. Africa is still 5 kilogram. But over and above that, the soils of Africa, all the way from Ethiopia to Senegal, are severely degraded. By erosion, by compaction, by depletion of organic matter, by mining of nutrients. And therefore, even when we apply improved varieties, even when the rain comes, the soil do not respond. And the only way to reverse that cycle is put back share of the land, of the organic matter that land produces, which is crop residues, root biomass, animal dung.
So, Doctor, I should pass along to you how alcohol fuel, done properly, actually serves these purposes. So, for instance, in Brazil and India, where alcohol is produced mostly from sugarcane, most people don't realize this, but nothing from the soil ends up in alcohol. Alcohol is made from the carbohydrates in the plant, and carbohydrates are carbon dioxide from the air and water, carbohydrate. So, at the end, the mash that's left over has everything in it that came from the soil that made the crop what it was before we fermented and distilled it.
Yeah.
So in Brazil, we take that liquid and they pipeline it back out of the alcohol plant, back into the same fields that the energy crop was grown in, returning all the nutrients which came from that soil back to the
soil. And all the humus, too. And the humus is what holds the soil together.
Correct. Yes, and so in this way, we are almost doing organic farming when we do energy cropping in both Brazil and in India. In Brazil, they take the sugarcane fiber, which they then use for energy. They burn the fiber to create the steam to run the alcohol plant and actually generate three times the electricity that they need and put it back in the grid. Notice no oil is being used in this process. And then
David,
they take the ash from the boilers, which has all the mineral content from the soil, and they return it back to the soil. So although we use up the carbon, you know, pretty completely in making alcohol, we do return the mineral wealth back to the soil, where it's then capable of trapping more carbon from the air.
And the mash and the humus, too. Professor?
David, I agree with everything you said. I'm very familiar with the sugarcane industry in southern Brazil, Piracicaba, Paraná State, and São Paulo. I worked with colleagues there. Here is the difference. If sugarcane, to produce sugarcane and make ethanol from this is a very different story than making ethanol from corn.
And I'd be happy to address that.
And the efficiency of conversion in two cases is very different.
Okay, good. Then we'll pick that up when we get back. We have to take a quick break,
good.
Professor Lau.
Okay.
But when I get back, I want to ask, do we have enough land to do both?
Exactly. Those are the two points. The efficiency of conversion and the land plus the water resources.
Okay.
Those
folks,
are the issues.
You've got the food chain. We're talking food or fuel. What do you think? The most important is we're open to your calls and comments. Pick up your phone and join us. We're at 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. We have Ratan Lal, professor of natural resources, Ohio State University. David Bloom, author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas. And, of course, we have you. So do stay tuned. Hey, welcome back. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking about food or fuel to stem the incredible prices increases being thrust upon us by OPEC and whoever else has hydrocarbons. We turn to ethanol as a possible solution. We we're dedicating one-third of our crop of corn to ethanol. And is that causing this incredible price increase in our foods? That's the question we're working with today. We have Professor Ratan Lal, who is a professor of natural resources at Ohio State University, a soil scientist. And we have David Bloom, author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas. And we're taking a quick look at this alcohol situation, and we're asking the question, do we have enough resources to grow both fuel and food? Or are we looking at an either-or situation? Tough one to figure out. In the developing world, we're almost to a point where we have no choice but to do something else than what we have been doing in the past. Would that be a fair assertion, Professor Lau?
Yes, I think so. I think the question that we were raising just before the break, number one, is there energy efficiency in ethanol derived from corn grains versus ethanol derived from sugarcane? That's one part. The second, is it possible perhaps to grow other sources of biomass or ethanol and biodiesel rather than converting corn, grain, and soybean?
Absolutely.
Right.
Ample switchgrass, miscanthus, algae, cyanobacteria, and these, and can we grow these plantations for biomass on land which is not cropland?
Yes.
Can we grow these crops on water which is not water for irrigation, saline water, for example?
Well, yes, we can absolutely do that, and we're sitting right here by the Pacific Ocean in this studio. You know, one of the best solutions in the long run for producing alcohol and energy actually is right here at the shoreline. In China, there are massive kelp farms. You know, kelp is a marine algae that grows 18 inches a day. It turns sunlight and nutrients in the water into fructose, which is a common sugar. And that's what kelp is made of, unlike land plants that are made of glucose. Now, you know, the American Gas Association, now these guys are hardly a bunch of tree huggers, you know. These are the people who sell natural gas. looked at the future and said, what if we went ahead and grew kelp off the coast of California? And they calculated how much energy could come from that, and they figured it at 15 quads of energy. Now, that's something that is a huge number that's hard to wrap your head around, but to put that in perspective, our whole gasoline supply is only 23 quads. So just the kelp off of California, fermented to make alcohol, would actually replace most of the gasoline in the country and, of course, absorb all the pollution out of the water. Because you got to realize, if you flush a toilet in California, eventually it ends up in the ocean. And that nutrient load is what
you mean they haven't figured a way around that yet, right?
Well, you know, as a former plumber, I can tell you the basic law is I have to know payday's on Friday and everything runs downhill. So the thing with kelp, of course, is that we can go ahead and make alcohol from the carbohydrates. But in organic farming, we all know that one of the best things we can use as a fertilizer is kelp solution. So the mash left over from making kelp into alcohol is the ideal broad-spectrum fertilizer that we can reapply to the land and stimulate plant growth, not nitrogen, but everything else we need.
What about the water costs? Professor Lau brought up the notion of water costs in a formula such as that you're talking about here, growing kelp.
Well,
do we
no
have
water
enough
cost.
Fresh water to do this?
Well, you know, water costs in an alcohol plant are pretty much used for cooling. The cooling towers are what are using the water in alcohol plants. New alcohol plants have stopped using water as a cooling agent because they're now getting more efficiency by doing the cooling with heat pumps, in other words, big air conditioners, that instead of cooling by evaporating water and wasting it, they're taking the energy that would otherwise be evaporated and capturing it and reusing it in the plant and reducing the
making
cost of the plant.
Making electricity or something like that.
Making heat, you know. So the water uses have actually dropped to a fraction of what they were only 5 years ago. And now some of the alcohol plants are taking the liquid byproduct, which used to be considered a place where water would be wasted because that to dry it for animal feed would take a lot of energy. Now they're starting to mix that with other like cellulosic crops and feeding it wet to animals, so saving the energy cost and not wasting the water. So, you know, as time goes on and energy and water become more expensive, you know, it's like the market has spoken, and so suddenly it's more cost effective to do things the ecological way, and we're now seeing that in the new alcohol plants.
Exactly. And what you're talking about is going back to a more decentralized form of energy production too, where villages around the world could produce their own cooking oil, for example.
Well, or even small municipalities. You know, one of the ways we can produce alcohol that is, you know, tremendously productive and uses water that's already in play are cattail marshes. You know, cattails, you've all seen them. They grow in the ditches. You see the little hot dog-like flower on top. Those cattails actually are used in 500 sewage treatment plants around the United States to clean up the water, taking out the nutrients. But they also produce about 60% starch as part of their metabolism, which is almost as good as corn, which is only 70% starch. Okay. So we can actually power the whole country using cattails processing sewage on less than 2% of the agriculturally rated land in the United States.
I love your optimism. It's so much fun.
Well, it's profitable, Michael, and so it's going to happen.
Well, let's go quickly to the phones and talk with Mike, who has a question about domestic alcohol production. Mike, welcome to the food chain.
Yes, thank you. Good morning, gentlemen. My query concerns the use of the sugar beet. It seems to me I have had some experience producing alcohol and distillation, so I think I know a little bit about what I'm talking about.
Now, what were you making? Were you making some moonshine out in the back 40? Is that what you were doing?
Well, as a youth, I did some of that, but I really don't enjoy drinking alcohol, so I'm not much.
Okay, just giving you a bad time.
But I know people who do. Okay, my point is that it seems to me that the sugar beet would be a more efficient source of alcohol than corn. Obviously, you have to convert corn into starch, into sugar by converting the starch. And it seems to me that the sugar beet can be grown in a lot more diverse areas than sugar cane.
That's true.
Let's go to Professor Lau. You were talking about sugar beets. What do you think?
Well, I think sugar beet, really grown in temperate climate, could be a source of ethanol as well. it's really not as efficient, and I think David said he was going to discuss that issue, it's really not as efficient as sugarcane is.
Well, my understanding is it's only about 15% sugar, but there's also a molasses portion that you get from the sugar beet, and that the waste product from the sugar beet is utilizable both as animal feed and for compost, and you could probably burn it to provide your distillation fuel.
Well, here's the basic deal on beets. Corn is about 250 gallons an acre. Fodder beets, which are our best energy beet, will produce 1,100 gallons per acre, but twice the animal feed on a dry weight basis as corn. There are now tropical sugar beets that mature in only 6 months, where sugarcane takes 18. So actually, where possible, beets actually outperform sugarcane in most cases. But sugarcane is very sustainable because it's a perennial crop. We plant it once, and we have to only harvest it. We can harvest
it
for
10
years.
It's like cutting the grass. Folks, going to have to take a quick break right back. Professor Ratan Lal, Professor of Natural Resources, Ohio State University. David Bloom, author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas. And you, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back. Well, it makes a lot of sense for people in the developing world to grow their own ethanol to cook with rather than using wood and crop residue and camel dung. By golly, it would improve the air and it would build the soil, and it just makes a lot of sense. But what about we who live in the developed world? We who live on food that comes from 2,000 miles away. Do we have a choice in this energy equation of food or fuel? Can we go on eating the way we have been? What do you think, Professor Lal?
Well, I think some of the issues really with biofuels are, and let me go back to the number of hungry people in the world. There are 1 billion people at the moment who do not have enough food. And the reason they do not have enough food is A, that it's not accessible because their income is less than $2 a day.
Exactly.
The prices have gone up tremendously, and there's a shortage of supply. And one other point which we have not discussed, in many countries such as Thailand, India, have stopped exporting food with fear that their own price inflation will go up tremendously. So the question really is, if we have 1 billion people starving and that number is increasing, is it justifiable to put corn grains, even though they are surplus? And I have no question about that, David, that they are surplus here, and we need to. But is it justified to put them into tank rather than into empty stomach?
Absolutely.
Which we really need, because I believe that food is the basic human right of every human being.
And I agree with you completely.
And we really have to. It is our moral duty to do everything we can to provide 3 square meals to every human being. And the number of people is right now 6.7 billion, out of which billions are starving, is going to increase. 3 billion more people are expected to come to this planet Earth between now and 2050. And all of those 3 billion, each and every one of them, is going to happen in developing countries of Africa, Asia, Caribbean, Andean region, where the natural resources, especially soil and water, are already under great stress. The food production has to be doubled, practically doubled. And therefore, the question is, do we need to fill our tanks with the food, or do we need to fill our stomach with the food? And the question is, we still need biofuel. There is no question about that. I am very strong in favor of biofuel. I think we should produce biofuel, like you said, algae, cyanobacteria, switchgrass, miscanthus, willow, poplar, mesquite, anything which we can go on degraded land.
Anything but corn.
Anything but corn, anything but food. Let's keep the food for people.
Okay,
David
so,
Bloom.
Gosh, there's so many things wrapped up in what you said, Doctor, and almost everything I agree with. First of all, like you pointed out, the big problem for people in developing countries is they can't afford the food. In reality, we grow twice as many calories in the world as everyone would need to eat. But the problem is, only people with money can afford to buy the food. So, for instance, you can feed 10 pounds of corn to a cow just to get 1 pound of meat, which is a very wasteful process because people in the United States can afford meat, and so the food is used inefficiently in the United States. But, of course, with alcohol fuel, it turns out that we can take the starch out first because cattle don't digest the starch. I mean, when you put 10 pounds of food into a cow, 9 pounds goes somewhere if it's not meat, and that's the manure. Most of that is starch. So if we went ahead and took the starch out first, we're then able to feed it to the cow. They actually gain more weight than they would have if they ate the original corn because the starch is out of the way. So we get food and fuel. So, Michael, your comment at the top of the hour, which is widely trumpeted in the press, one-third of our corn is being diverted to alcohol fuel, is a lie. Because only the corn starch goes into alcohol fuel. The byproduct, dried distillers grains, is still fed to animals and actually increases the meat supply. And dried distillers grains are a good human food. The cost of shipping the stuff across the ocean to people who need it is actually greater than the cost of the corn itself. Since dried distillers grains are the concentrated protein and much better food, it only costs one-third as much to ship it to other countries. So by making alcohol here, we actually, even from corn, which is by far the least favorite energy crop, would actually make more food available for people in poor countries. But what's more important in other countries is that we start looking at integrated agriculture. So, for instance, in the way I talk about it in my book, if you take a raw material and you make alcohol with it, let's say it's corn even, which is not the best crop, the byproduct you'd then take from my alcohol plant and you'd feed it to fish. Tilapia is a good choice. So 1.6 pounds of corn makes a pound of tilapia. That's a lot better than 10 pounds
for
corn.
This is kind of the farmers of 40 centuries way of doing things, isn't it?
Well, this is almost your way of doing things, Michael, the metro farming method, because we take the corn, run it through the fish, we get a pound and a half of fish, a pound of fish out for every pound and a half of corn. But that half a pound went somewhere, went into the water. So now we can either take that water and grow spirulina with it, which is a nitrogen-fixing, carbon dioxide-fixing bacteria, which we can then feed to animals, and that's more feed or people. Or we could take that fish water and grow organic vegetables. But if we're doing it at the alcohol plant, we have it in greenhouses, which the air enriched from carbon dioxide from the fermenters, and we get 9 times the yield per square foot than we do outdoors. So alcohol plants ought to be concentrated food production facilities, reusing all the byproducts over and over again, so we get much more food and we get fuel too.
Okay, I have to take a quick break, last break. So much to talk about in so little time, but I have to ask each of our guests today, do we have a choice anymore? Can we go on doing things the way we have in the past? Well, living on a food chain built on cheap energy. What do you think? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back with Ratan Lal, Professor of Natural Resources, Ohio State, David Bloom. Alcohol can be a gas. Stay tuned. Well, the question on the table is, do we have a choice? We built a food chain that relies on cheap energy of hydrocarbons. And for many, many years, hydrocarbons were very cheap. But now they're not cheap anymore. The price of them is going through the roof, and so is the price of food. So do we have a choice here? Can we rely on that food chain that was built on cheap oil? Professor Lal, what do you think? Oops, I got a precious button here. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Professor Lal.
Yeah, there are a couple of other points which I think need attention, and I really appreciate having such a commonality of ideas with David. One is that we need to improve production of food. The productivity, the crop yields in Africa, for example.
And we need to enrich the soil, don't we?
Enrich the soil. That's one part. We need to enrich the soil. The second part is, which David brought up, people are so poor, less than $2 a day, the prices have gone up, they can't afford to buy the food. Well, one very good news was that the wheat price now in Afghanistan is more than that of opium. So that's a good thing. Wheat now rather than opium. But the question is, how can we make these poor farmers adopt the new agricultural technology that they cannot afford? Now, here is an idea. If we can, rather than giving them handouts, which are demoralizing and which are...
Right, amen to that.
I think we should pay them for ecosystem services that the farmers can provide. They can do carbon sequestration to mitigate climate change. They can improve water quality. They can decrease hypoxia, of course.
It's kind of like we're doing here, isn't
exactly,
it?
Exactly like we do here for CRP and other things that we do. So if we can pay those farmers, if you adopt this improved technology and you provide ecosystem services, we pay you for that.
Okay, David Bloom, do we have a choice? Can we rely on that food chain built on cheap oil anymore?
Well, we can't. We never could, actually, because it's been destroying our fertility for the last 100 years. And, you know, we just can't keep doing that at all. Alcohol fuel and the techniques Dr. Lau are pointing out are ways we build back our soil fertility. And if we don't make biofuels, though, we will end up with climate-destroying coal to liquids, oil, shale, petroleum, and tar sands petroleum, which are all climate killers.
Those are the camel dung of hydrocarbons. Right?
Yes, and much worse, you know. But the real solution, which is right in line with what Dr. Lau is saying, is that it's cheap for us to do this the right way. If we went ahead and provided the infrastructure for farmers to plug into to make food and fuel at alcohol plants, then we would solve the problems neatly.
Yes, but that does not address the issue of centralization of energy.
And I am going to address that for you right now, Michael. If we built cooperative distilleries all over the planet, it would cost us right now, at the current cost of building alcohol plants, small and large, from village size to bigger, about $500 billion to build enough plants to replace all the oil in the world.
Wouldn't that destroy OPEC?
It would absolutely destroy OPEC, and it would provide all the food people need and all the energy. And we've already spent more than $500 billion in Iraq today. If we would have spent that money on building alcohol plants around the world, people would have enough food, they'd have enough energy, and what would be left to fight over?
Well, there's a good question. I'm sure we'd find something, because we usually do. Professor Lau, thank you so much. You see some optimism, hope for the future?
Oh, I think so. I'm very optimistic. I think the technology exists. We have proven those. It's a matter of providing policy incentives to farmers, especially in developing countries.
Okay, I've got to go. David Bloom, Professor Lau, thank you both so much for joining us. And thank you out there for tuning in. Remember, cheap food isn't. See you next week for more What's Eating What Radio, right here on The Food Chain.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.